Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, one of your hosts. Today, we'll be talking to Lucy Delap, reader in modern British and gender history at Murray Edwards College, Cambridge University, about her new book, Feminisms, A Global History. Lucy's a gender historian writ large. Her first book, The Feminist Avant-Garde, Cambridge 2007, examined the development of feminist ideas in the Anglo-American context, tracing the ideas across the Atlantic. She directed her gaze back to her homeland and subsequent publications, The Politics of Domestic Authority in Britain Since 1800, Palgrave 2009, and Knowing Their Place, Domestic Service in 20th Century Britain, Oxford 2011. Then with the 2013 Palgrave release, Men, Masculinities, and Religious Change in Britain Since 1890, Dr. Delap explored another expression of gender altogether. Her latest work, Feminisms, A Global History, due out with Penguin Press later this year, is what we'll be discussing today. Hello, Lucy, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Yana. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful. I'm very excited. How are you? Glorious day in Cambridge?
It's raining, actually, which is quite helpful for the lockdown. It keeps us all at home.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, I'm in Amsterdam, so rain is, you know, my life. I'm familiar. It's nice. When the sun is shining, it feels like it's mocking us right now, doesn't it?
It does. But we did have an incredible kind of couple of months of lockdown that coincided with an unprecedented heat wave, which was actually really wonderful for people who could get out into the sun.
Making this all a little bit better. It's a very good time to read books, actually, as we stay home. So Let's get into yours. I want to start by saying how very much I enjoyed this book and how excited I am to discuss it.
Thank you. That's really kind of you.
So I'm wondering if you could, like, let's start it. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to do this work?
Yes, I'm a historian of Britain, although as you said in your kind intro, I've always kind of looked more broadly to transnational elements as well. And I was asked to write a book, a kind of introductory book about feminisms, but I wasn't given any kind of brief. And I thought hard about this, and I considered writing it about just kind of domestic British history. I thought, no, I don't think that would work well at all. I wondered if I should stay in my sort of comfort zone, which is more Anglo-American and also British imperial. And then I thought, well, really, there has been an extraordinary flowering of literature on global feminisms in the past decade. And I didn't feel that the kind of introductory general accounts of feminism really reflected that. So what really excited me was trying to synthesize and draw together some of those literatures. And, you know, for me, that was a massive learning journey about, you know, writing about contexts that I didn't know. And where I was very much relying on the, you know, the wonderful labors of other people and trying to bring those things into dialogue and to see whether there was, in fact, a global feminist story that could be told at the same time as trying to, you know, pluralize feminisms and make it clear that there's not just one thing called feminism. You know, that just really inspired me as a project. And I think I think that historians of gender and feminism, you know, we've always been quite able to move across different subfields because, you know, it's not clear what kind of history we do, if you like. We're not, just political historians. Sometimes we get called social historians. Sometimes we write about culture. We write about labor. We move nimbly across all those different realms. And I think that gives us a certain amount of sort of confidence in dropping in on other fields and, you know, taking from them and drawing out stories that unite those fields. So even though it was pretty daunting to try and write something about global history, I felt as though, the field allowed me to do that. And, you know, this is also about my own personal history as somebody, you know, very committed to exploring what it means to be a feminist located in the academy, thinking about what kinds of feminist interventions I want to make. And also my own background. I went to school as a school child, secondary school in Southern Africa, at a very exciting, febrile, extraordinary political time in the late 80s, early 90s, to be living as I was in what was then called the frontline state of Eswatini, right on the border of apartheid South Africa. You know, I really was living that that struggle up close, if you like, and got very interested in questions of anti-racism, social justice, looking at poverty, but also looking at strategies for social change and trying to set them into dialogue with questions of gender justice. That for me, you know, really makes sense of some of my own kind of lineage as a person and as an intellectual.
Oh, yeah, that makes great sense. 'Cause the global work here, like, is really strong. I mean, I want to say, like, I'm a feminist researcher, and I also teach the history of feminism. So you were really writing this book for me. thank you. But I'm just so happy to have this outstanding new resource, because there's the we've had this kind of flowering of thinking about feminism as something other than, you know, Mary Wollstonecraft to Gloria Steinem.
That's right.
But there's not been any kind of really suitable thing to give to our students. And this is it. This is a great thing. And I think part of the deal is your structure and the way you organize your ideas. So I want to talk about that. Because many a history book is organized like chronologically, earliest stuff to yesterday, clear progression.
Yep.
But you don't do that. You have these 8 thematic chapters. Like, how did you make that decision?
Oh, well, I have to confess that I wrote a chronological book proposal. Mm-hmm. And it just bored the pants off me. You know, when I was writing it, I just thought, oh, I have to do this. It's going to be a slog, but I'm going to grind this out. I wrote the book proposal. I kind of sat on it for a day or two. I looked at it and I thought, well, if it was that boring for me to write it, and if the prospect of writing the book is not exciting me, how's it going to be for a reader? It's going to be just as dull. So I ditched the worthy book proposal, if you like, and I started thinking about what it would be like to write this more as a set of interlocking stories, mm-hmm. really foregrounding that idea of storytelling, of characters, of peopling the history of feminism, and setting alongside the peopling of it also some other kind of quirky stuff, like trying to think about sensory history, thinking about how we can hear feminisms, touch feminisms, how we can write material culture in. And just kind of thinking about both inspiration and also critical history, it kind of worked better for me to do this thematic organization. And it allowed me to do the global in a way that, you know, makes no attempt at comprehensivity. I mean, you could not write a book of this kind of introductory length about the global terrain and not just miss out whole swathes of it. Now, this book also misses whole swathes of it. I mean, it does what it does. It's a very patchy account of the global, but I wanted to be able to dot around, if you like, mm-hmm. to put different parts of the world into dialogue with each other in a way that I'm sure some of my more kind of traditional-minded colleagues will find disconcerting, but which I hope is a fun read and which opens up debates that I don't think I could have done if I had structured it chronologically.
Yeah, I think it's masterful. You know, we historians tend to think chronologically, of course, and there's a benefit there. But I fear it contributes to the notion that there's some grand narrative of progress in which things have gotten continually better, right? We've developed. And
it does lend itself to that, right? And the whole premise of this book is against that, is talking about circularity. It's talking about reuse and hybrid adaptation. You know, I've put at the center of the book a metaphor of the idea of mosaics. Now, I don't think that any one metaphor is going to be like the catch-all for all our insights. And there are some wonderful metaphors already out there in feminist history, such as, you know, Karen Offen's idea of lava and eruptions, or one that I cite in the book, Nancy Hewitt's wonderful idea of radio waves. Those are exciting metaphors as well. But my own kind of mosaics idea, I wanted to have that sense of, you know, the little pieces, if you like, that go to make up feminisms that get recombined in different kinds of ways, that are borrowed, are recomposed into new patterns. And some of those bits fall out and get lost and perhaps get completely forgotten. Others, we can sort of make out the pattern, but we have to imagine it because maybe the archive doesn't give us the full account. Mm-hmm. Some just get destroyed. So it was a useful metaphor for me of kind of getting us to try and think away from those linear narratives and getting us to think about patterning, if you like.
Wonderful. Yeah, brilliant. And you're able to do this, I think, as well because of the wide variety, the really delightful textured variety of sources you use. And I think as we go through this kind of chapter by chapter, we can talk about that a little bit more. So I'd like to delve in. So the first two chapters, I think, kind of go together, and they're called Dreams and Ideas, and they focus on the lives of women's minds. So can you tell me what you do here?
Yes, well, feminism has many faces and many different kinds of dreams, and I wanted to set alongside each other three different ways of figuring dreams, all of which were produced within 20 years of each other in the early 20th century. So I start off with three different narratives, one produced in revolutionary early Soviet Russia, Alexandra Kollontai's vision of what love and society should look like. That's set alongside a piece produced in colonial Bengal by Rokeya Hussain, who writes about what she calls Ladyland, an imagined future where women dominate. And then the progressive era United States feminist Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who writes about what she calls her land. So there's three kind of fantasies, if you like, which show feminism not just as a political struggle, but as a wish and a desire for a different kind of future, but that can be figured very, very differently. And of course, all of those writers are kind of working within their distinctive contexts. And then I try and talk about figures who've tried to actualize their dreams. And that I turn to Pandita Ramabai, who worked in Maharashtra state, what is now Maharashtra state in India, to actualize her vision of a refuge for widows, a place of learning, a place of safety, and how complicated that is for her to try and set that up. So there's kind of utopia in this chapter, utopia imagined, utopia worked for. And then, you know, finally, I then move on to some of the sort of psychic complications of dreams, looking at some actual dreams. We don't have that many actual dreams, but, you know, feminists and activists who've dreamt literally about their politics, including a wonderful dream from John Stuart Mill, the 19th century British philosopher, about, his sort of, I guess you could say, his sexual investments in particular ideas of femininity and how complicated that was for him to think about and dream about. So, I mean, there's an introduction to the psychic pressures, I guess, of imagining a different future and ways in which that has also come out very strongly over the pressures and the tensions around race and sexuality. That's kind of, I guess I would say it's a like an overall theme running through the book, is the idea that feminists are often asking, not exclusively, but often asking for inclusion into systems of power, into institutions, but that, you know, the story of feminisms is also about exclusion. It's also about, you know, policing the boundaries. And that comes out very much in this chapter on dreams, to remind us of how people's dreams don't necessarily always fit together. And there's a kind of long exploration of Audre Lorde and her criticism of Adrienne Rich, which comes out in their dialogues, in poetry. So a sort of, you know, troubling questions about the problems of dreams. You know, we cannot just write a feminist history which is about wonderful dreams. It has to be about the slightly nightmarish edge as well.
Yeah, would that were the world, right?
Yeah. And then, I mean, I've set that with a chapter which is about ideas, because I think we have to accept that, you know, feminism is an intellectual formation as well, a very diverse one. And that was a chance to introduce some very significant intellectual kind of strands of feminist history, thinking about utopian socialist and Marxist traditions, but also, you know, weaving in amongst that the influence of things like republicanism, constitutionalism, radical and revolutionary feminist thinking, black feminist thinking, psychoanalytic thinking, and so on. So trying to give people jumping off points, I guess, into those various different traditions. And setting that in a global story where we think about, you know, very well-recognized concepts, resources like the idea of patriarchy, and ask ourselves, well, how does that figure in other places? You know, what is it like to try and draw out, as I do in this chapter, ideas about the gender order and structural gender disadvantage that develop in China in the early 20th century around terms such as nanu, which we could translate as patriarchy, but which need to be given their own story in their own context.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. So I think we want to talk then about the next three chapters together. Feminism on the physical plane. And those chapters mm-hmm. are space, objects, and looks.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with these chapters because I find that literature on how feminisms develop in a spatial sense, how they play out in cities or in domestic spaces, how they reclaim certain spaces, mm-hmm. how they might also, you know, reclaim or repurpose objects. All of that is it's very new. It's very new kinds of approaches. And it really helps us move on from, you know, sort of, I guess, tireder, older histories, which see feminism as a kind of series of canonical thinkers. Mm-hmm. And it takes us into a different kind of scale. And again, the kind of the mosaic metaphor, I wanted to get at that idea of scale, you know, the idea that you can go up close to a mosaic and you can see the really granular detail of the pieces, you know, the cement that's holding it together, what a specific, you know, gorgeous little piece of glass or ceramic or whatever it might be looks like. And then you can step back and you completely lose the sight of that little piece and you get this big picture. And in this chapter, I'm going very close. So I'm looking at specific objects. I mean, like the speculum, for example, mm-hmm. an object which is both a kind of, we associate it with the very hostile spaces that have sometimes emerged in medicine for women, spaces where women have not been listened to, where their bodies have been kind of controlled. But we also think about the speculum as being reclaimed by the women's movement, by mm-hmm. it being redesigned so that it's in warm plastic rather than cold metal, being sold in feminist bookshops, being used in consciousness raising groups for women to understand the spaces of their own bodies. And then linking that back into a story of how the speculum was developed in slaveholding America by a physician who used it and developed it without their consent on slave women. So trying to, you know, always step away from the kind of the object itself into that wider history. So we can see those big stories of enslavement the big kind of macro narratives of world history that can help us make sense of something, you know, very, very small, like a specific object. So that was a lot of fun for me. And it's amazing how many kind of feminist things there are, if you like. And it also was a chance to write about a subject that I'm working on in other projects, the idea of the kind of intersection between feminisms and commerce, mm-hmm. and the way in which it's been hugely important for part of the movement to be about women making money, women trading. And so thinking about the kinds of objects that were traded famously as part of the suffrage movement, which was very savvy and entrepreneurial at developing, you know, suffrage fans and suffrage pins and brooches and hats and handbags and tobacco pouches and all sorts. But also in other places where feminists trade. And really, for me, it's publishing and feminist magazines and books that I love and feel great inspiration for. So you can see that I'm dotting around a lot here, but it was great fun to look at that. And then just to kind of wind up that section, the chapter on looks, it is sort of about who does the looking, right? There's a wonderful feminist tradition of thinking about the male gaze, but it's more about fashion and dress and, you know, what does it mean to dress like a feminist, mm-hmm. and how have feminists theorized and understood fashion? That's the real focus there. And some of that is about reform movement, so dress reform. You know, there's some tantalizing glimpses we get there of, for example, one of the illustrations in the book, the photo is of early 20th century Maori dress reformers who are wearing these wonderful blazers and knickerbockers and shirts. But, you know, sadly, I don't know how they came to make that clothing choice, or, you know, what meanings they attached to it. But it reminds us of how significant dress reform has been. I turn to Islamic feminisms, which is, as I see it, you know, a really pressing theme to write about, because I think in today's context, it's hugely important to remember that there are lots of mm-hmm. Islamic feminisms, that there's a kind of whole rich tradition of thinking about feminisms that grow from different kinds of faith traditions. Mm-hmm. So looking at the conflicts over veiling and different kinds of head covering, I remind readers that it's not just in Islamic contexts that women have adopted head covering. So I take us to 19th century Lima in Peru, where women also covered their heads, but in ways that have been widely read as empowering for their freedom to move around in urban spaces. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to, if you like, reread the veil as a source of control and discomfort, but also just as commonly a source of control by women themselves about how they choose to present themselves. And, you know, I think it's hugely important for you know, myself in Britain, for you in the Netherlands, where there is a huge backlash against visible signs of Muslim faith and enormous state harassment of women who choose to veil. It's really important to develop a historical contextualization of that, mm-hmm. to understand why the right to veil needs to be a feminist issue.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that a counter narrative that sees it as control of, you know, female control of their own bodies and self-presentation.
Right. That's
which
right.
is something that I think that I loved these chapters, because you can see the way that women on the ground control their lives. There's very much about self-presentation and consumption, and kind of the way that this felt very, close to home, very like practical.
Oh, it's great to hear you say that. And, you know, I kind of explore the idea in this book of it, this being a usable history. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways in which I hope it's usable is that it resonates with, the life experiences that people have had today, the campaigning they may have done or the campaigning they may be inspired to do by it. So, you know, I think this particular bit about Islamic feminism is one of the places where I feel as though, yes, the use of this in today's debates is very clear. Mm-hmm. Although I also think it's important, you know, not to write histories that are just about the uses that we have for them today. And so, you know, I also want to introduce readers to ideas of feminisms that are, you know, really quite different from what they may have been expecting. There's no kind of, you know, genealogy of feminist foremothers here. There's some quite challenging episodes of feminist history and quite other from our today concerns.
Yeah, we've got some issues in the 19th century with those women, just for instance.
Yeah.
But, you know, something like the concept of space and how feminine space and domestic space has been constructed by women and by people who'd like to control women is a good theme across time.
You know? Absolutely. And, you know, thinking critically about, you know, what kind of space is the workplace? Is it a space of empowerment for whom, you know, how do people need to sometimes defend themselves from the depredations of the workplace, if you like, as well as just claim it? How can women claim spaces for religious worship, for example? I love the case study in the chapter on spaces, which is about Violet Johnson and her attempts to create a space for an African-American, predominantly female, predominantly domestic servant congregation in New Jersey, faced with a very difficult Jim Crow racialized landscape. You know, that for me was a great chance to go up close to the life of somebody who's not a well-known figure, who is representing the leadership of a woman of color, a working class woman. Her resourcefulness and her commitment to creating spaces, you know, that for me was inspirational.
Mm-hmm. Very much. So shall we talk about the chapter entitled Feelings?
Yeah, Feelings. Well, this is about history of emotions, a massively growing field, a really thriving field, which, you know, I hadn't really seen reflected in any of the existing introductions to feminisms. So I really wanted there to be a kind of strong emotional component here. And I can't do it justice, but I hope I've kind of, you know, scratched at the surface of what we might do in thinking about feminist history as a history of feelings. And this, I think, is one that resonates, again, very, very strongly with some of the campaigning that we see today for women, you know, not to be compliant, for women not to perform the kind of, you know, the emotions that they're expected to perform. So thinking of somebody like Deepa Narayan, who's an activist against rape and violence that women are suffering in India, you know, who says very clearly, women need to make a noise, women need to stop smiling so that, you know, they do not perform sort of conventional femininity, which leaves them at risk of violence, as well as, of course, noting that the police need to change, Indian men need to change, the state needs to change its policy. But that focus on the, you know, the smile and how dangerous it is, which Sara Ahmed has talked about, you know, the need for the feminist snap to refuse to smile, to refuse to try and make people happy around you, to not put happiness at the center of your life. You know, these are very powerful ideas for us today. And, you know, to go back historically and to find women across, you know, 250 years also engaging with these ideas of, you know, what is it to feel emotions? What kind of emotions should we seek to feel? We see it in, you know, Henrik Ibsen's Dollhouse play. We see it in the 18th century writer Josefa Amari Barbón, who's one of my favorite figures of the book, actually, who was an Aragonese intellectual of the sort of second half of the 18th century. You know, they really challenge the emotional status quo, if you like. And so the feelings here are very much of anger, of refusal to emotionally conform, but also of love, also the ways in which the movement produces positive affects, of solidarity, of love that is sometimes understood as, the kind of political solidarity between campaigners, but which might also have elements of sexual desire, of same-sex selfhood and subjectivity, of maternal love. There are so many ways in which love is a great jumping off point into different kinds of elements of feminist and women's movements. So there was a chance to talk quite a lot about the kind of distinctive theorization of maternal love that came from Scandinavian feminists, such as Ellen Key, but also which developed in Latin American contexts, where there's a sort of particular both Catholic and indigenous spiritual account of what a mother might be. So again, a chance to kind of to move between different parts of the women's movement and think about its emotional emotional truths.
Nice. All right, and then we've got the next two chapters are behaviors, or I'm sorry. Then let's just talk about behaviors, right?
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, there's a chapter on action, what it is to take feminist action, what strategies are there. And, you know, this is needed because we just have to keep in the picture the idea that feminisms are about both theory and making change happen. And, you know, to really bring into view that sense of what do people do to actualize their politics, if you like. And this goes from quite familiar stories about suffrage militancy in China and in Britain, kind of well-known interventions taken up in Australia by later both labor activists and women's liberation activists. But also the ways in which a lot of the women's struggles and movements around the world are reacting against ideas of militancy and violence, and exploring alternative ways of making change happen through tactics such as picketing, striking, and striking, of course, extends across the labor struggles that women have often been involved with, but also to strikes over sex or domestic work, or, you know, proposals to have birth strikes. I'm not sure that one ever got off the ground, but, you know, certainly across France, the USA, Iceland, there's been all sorts of creative innovations around what it might mean to withdraw your labor in different kinds of ways. There's a nice thread in that chapter as well on nakedness and what it means to strip, set across different kinds of places, from Nigeria to South Korea to Australia again, you know, the meanings of women's bodies, to the Ukraine, where Femen has been a recent, about 10 years ago, mm-hmm. phenomenon. So yes, the thinking about women's bodies and how they are part of the arsenal, if you like, of mm-hmm. Of tactics of making change happen.
I think that was, I liked very much, and I think it's a very clever decision to talk about nudity and nakedness as an action, not as a feeling or as an object, but that this is a thing that is done, right?
Right. And you know, the kind of relationship between feminisms and bodies mm-hmm. is a really interesting one to probe. And it comes up again and again, because, of course, bodies are sites of enormous power, and mm-hmm. The feelings, the resources, the labor, the cultural and psychological significance of bodies are there again and again. But of course, not all these women's movements and feminisms feel the same about their bodies. Mm-hmm. And we need to keep in view the fact that modest dress and feelings of wanting to treat the body in a culturally appropriate way are important too. And there's a lovely example of this. It's one of my favorite kind of feminist objects in the book. A book that was produced, it was published by Kali for Women, which is a Indian feminist publisher. And it was a book called Sharir Ki Jankari, which translates as about the body. written by rural women in Rajasthan. And it was a book produced in the 1970s, which was about introducing rural women to sex education, to thinking about their bodies as a site of struggle, if you like. So thinking mm-hmm. about marital rape, thinking about sex selection that has worked against female fetuses mm-hmm. and so on. And what's interesting there is that the body was initially shown naked in the book. And when they started circulating that book amongst rural village women, the response was that, you know, this book doesn't correspond to our experience of women's bodies. We don't actually see women's bodies naked, nor do we want to see women's bodies naked. So they changed the format of the book to create clothed bodies, but bodies that had little kind of lift the flap bits incorporated, so that you could have a look and see what was underneath the clothes. And, you know, that strikes me as a kind of wonderful adaptation of a kind of model of feminist publishing that, you know, was not working well for the women who had who were using it, and a brilliant attempt to recraft it for that local context. So yes, bodies are very present in this book, and bodies are absolutely a site of active change.
And negotiation, right? I mean, there's this negotiation as well between Western feminisms. That's its own kind of problematic term, but like how women interact with their own bodies, and is just it's a really a rich idea that you handle very well.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's and then your penultimate chapter, Delightful, was called Songs.
Yeah, and I was hoping that people would be able to listen to feminisms. And of course, like, one could pick any number of like cultural sites, I don't know, theater, literary production, and think about how women have been historically excluded from it, and think about how they have also contributed to it. And, you know, for me, music is very important. I play music myself. And so it was super exciting for me to think about, you know, how do we hear feminisms? And I have to say that kind of goes beyond just music and song, but to think about all sorts of audio components as well. So how do we think about practices such as humming and wailing and moaning and keening, which have been used as part of protest mm-hmm. culture in prisons, on marches, in peace camps. So, you know, there's a very kind of like diverse soundscape, I guess, of feminisms. Mm-hmm. And I wanted readers to actually literally be able to hear this. So there's a link in the book to a Spotify playlist, which has some of my favorite feminist anthems. Now, Spotify does not go back much further than the 1920s. So it can't cover the whole span of this book by any means. And lots of feminist music and song is lost to us. You know, it was produced in the moment, or it was never recorded. So there's limits to what you can do on Spotify. But nonetheless, the playlist, which is about 6 or 7 hours long, is an amazing array of feminist music or music that you know engages with feminist themes. And it was produced by a series of social media posts in 7 different languages, which invited people to submit the music that they thought of when they thought of feminisms and the women's movement. So, you know, it's much broader, certainly, than my own musical knowledge would ever have taken it. And, you know, hundreds of people got in touch with me with brilliant suggestions about what can go on it. And it's still very much a work in progress. So, you know, I've put my Twitter handle in the book in a footnote and said, you know, any reader who wants to suggest stuff can get in touch, and I'll keep adding to that playlist. Because I'd love to, you know, to know what do readers think needs to be heard when we think about feminist music.
This is so remarkable in a history book. Right. And at this way that I think you have to maybe even be an historian and to have sat through, you know, those like intellectual histories, just plugged your way through them. the idea that there can be a Spotify playlist in a serious study is so, it's mind blowing and really delightful. God, it's good.
Well, I hope people will enjoy it. And you know, there really is a rich landscape out there. And I learned a lot myself about, you know, Riot Girl, for example. I've been listening to lots of fantastic feminist punk. And, you know, the way in which Riot Girl has spanned the world from, West Coast American origins to Russia, to Brazil, to Indonesia is just incredible. And, you know, this is still very much a movement in progress. So it's super exciting to bring this up to the present day. And, you know, the recent, viral progress of the Chilean feminist chant, Un Mirador en Tu Camino, produced by Las Tesis, the feminist collective in Chile, but performed across the world, you know, in Mexico, in the Turkish parliament, in Britain and America, in France. It's just been an extraordinary kind of moment of global reuse, if you like, of a chant that has different words, different translations, different meanings, but which unifies people in a kind of feminist global imaginary. It absolutely speaks to what I've tried to do in this book.
Yeah, and this like unification. Well, and song is so important. It's such a place. Well, I mean, it's how we discuss for millennia. It's how we make sense of things, right, as a species. Mm. And it's a place still where women are in a lot of ways excluded. I mean, I'm just thinking about the number of times you hear someone just casually say, like, I don't really like to hear women's voices. I prefer male singers.
Yeah, well, that speaks to me. I remember one of the first experiences I had in a Cambridge college where I sat down at a celebration welcome dinner, and I happened to be sat next to the director of music of that college, and I asked him, "How come it's just a male only choir in this college?" And he said, "Oh, well, it's because of the quality of women's voices. You know, they don't have quite the same purity of blah blah blah." Anyway. and I pushed him on it, and I said, you know, that just sounds absolute bonkers to me. You know, it doesn't make any sense. In the end, I have to say, he acknowledged that actually there's no reason why you couldn't have a mixed sex choir. And he said, no, really, what it is that women are much more mature, socially mature than men. So if you had girls in the choir as well as boys, it would kind of embarrass the boys because the boys are very juvenile and the girls are sort of grow up too quickly. And, you know, so they would be a disruptive social influence.
Oh, good.
And, you know, at that point, I have to say, I actually moved seats rather than stay in that conversation.
Yeah, that wise choice. Oh, okay. Yeah. And the idea too, I mean, and we're policing women in vocal fry and the way teenage girls talk, it's a very, God, yeah. I can't believe that. Well, okay, women can sing, but it would upset the boys. Well done, you, that you didn't just like kick him in the shin.
Probably could have done. Ethel Smith, who's another feminist composer who features in this book, she was very important to the women's suffrage movement in early 20th century Britain, and she wrote a very famous feminist anthem called The March of the Women. She had an opera that she wrote, performed at the Met in New York in 1903, and it was described by its reviewers as quaint and feminine. And then the Met did not stage another opera written by a woman until 2016. So Jesus. Yeah, this question of women's exclusion from kind of cultural resources and cultural power, and the tendency that there is to judge women's cultural productions by some kind of different set of metrics that, you know, this is just by a woman. This is very hardwired, I would say, in lots of places in a cultural sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So you conclude your book with global feminisms, where you make some broad observations. So this would be a good time now. Is there anything you'd like to say here to conclude our discussion of this book?
Well, I think just to kind of sum up, I guess this is a book that tries to both provincialize and decenter Europe, but also sort of Anglo-American interpretations of feminisms. And it does that not in a kind of doctrinaire sense, right? It's not saying, oh, we can't look at Europe just because Europe's bad, but in a sense of saying, actually, European and American feminisms developed very much in dialogue with these other parts of the world that I do a lot of work with in the book, you know, places like the Philippines or Argentina and Chile or Japan, you know, that there was a global conversation. I don't think the global conversation is always as vivid and as engaged across the whole kind of 250 years that the book covers. I think we can pick out moments, decades sometimes, when the connections were very, very strong. So thinking about the kind of the revolutionary moment of the late 18th century and the wars of that kind of turn of the century going into the 19th mm-hmm. century, that was a period where there was a lot of global debate and a kind of a global imaginary was very vivid. The 1840s, another incredible decade of sort of revolutionary thinking, is another one that kind of jumps out. About 1910 to 1920, it's an incredible period of revolt and, again, war. So you know, I think we can go back and say, like, here's bits where the debate is very strong and where connections are made very strongly. But I mean, as a broad finding, to discover that we're not just pluralizing feminisms, but we are actually picking out shared tactics, shared ideas, the movement of texts, the movement of people, was quite surprising to me. I thought that this might be a more divided, disjointed story than it actually turned out to be. In fact, sometimes I thought, I just can't do this thematic organization, because how am I going to be able to bring together, you know, the different stories that, you know, might develop in, you know, in Kenya or in Russia or in Japan. But it actually always proved possible to craft a kind of narrative that pointed out those moments of global simultaneity. And, mm-hmm. you know, we are right now today at a moment of global simultaneity. Right, we're facing the simultaneous rise of populisms. We're facing a pandemic, which is you know, both uniting and dividing mm-hmm. the world. But we're all experiencing it in different kinds of ways. But at the same moment, we're experiencing a kind of a climate emergency, which knows no national borders. And these things are, I think, helping us to ask those questions of our histories, right? To ask, where do you get these kinds of moments of global simultaneity? And you definitely get that with women's movements and feminisms. And within that sort of larger remit of where is the thinking global, if you like, I also want not just to provincialize Europe, but also to go down to the level of individual women, and to point to the ways in which working class women, women of color, women who've been marginalized by their refugee status or by colonial occupation, you know, they have often provided the both the intellectual and the activist leadership in making change happen. So this is a book that puts those figures very much to the fore.
Outstanding. All right. So what's next? What are you working on now?
Well, I mentioned feminist commerce, and I'm part of a fantastic project called The Business of Women's Words, which is a collaboration with the British Library, which looks at feminist publishing in Britain in the 1970s, looks at different kinds of models of feminist publishing, and tries to kind of unite that, the activist feminist history, if you like, of Virago Press, of Spare Rib, and of numerous other publishing projects, tries to unite that with the business history of, you know, what is it to be an entrepreneur? What is it to provide employment and create products and market and distribute those products? So that's an interesting learning process for me in trying to understand better what the specific economic context is for those feminist projects. And my other big project is, I'm very interested in the histories of, people with intellectual disabilities or learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of going back to some of my labor history, past to try to write, how people with intellectual disabilities made their way in the labor market. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of mm-hmm. fun because people haven't really approached the topic historically from that direction very much. they've always tended to be histories of sort of incarceration. How did people get marooned in asylums and workhouses and colonies? And then how did they get out? That's been a really important story to tell. But I think it's meant that the story of how did the majority of people with intellectual disabilities who were not institutionalized, how did they live their lives? How did they make a living? So that's another new project.
Ooh, that sounds very fun as well. I guess fun's a relative word, but very cool. All right.
Thank you.
So Lucy, I've taken tons of your time, so I think we'll call this good. But thank you so much for being on the show. I've really enjoyed our chat.
It's an absolute pleasure. It was lovely to talk with you, Jana.
Oh, wonderful. And I'll be getting in touch for your next books.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.